It's Wednesday, July 2nd, and it's 4:20 somewhere in the world. I'm your host, Radical Russ Belville. Produced and distributed by the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws in Washington, D.C., this is your normal daily audio stash, the growing truth about cannabis. Welcome to the most popular podcast regarding marijuana in all of America and all the world, featuring interviews with scientists, politicians, doctors, prohibition policy activists, regular cannabis consumers, musicians, and Normal's staff and Normal's board of directors, along with music and comedy no other podcast can offer. You can always find out more about our show at our website, stash.normal.org. and continue the education and conversation on our blog as well. We're ending marijuana prohibition with education, one listener at a time. The podcasting and blogging technology for the Normal Daily Audio Stash is provided by Red Aphid Interactive Media. For your professional web design needs, visit redaphid.com. Hey, Stashers, welcome to the middle of the week. Glad to have you here. Hope you're enjoying the middle of the year. That's right. July 2nd is exactly the middle of our year. So happy mid-year, I guess. We got some great interviews for you today. We're going to be talking with Dr. Mitch Earlywine to get our dose of cannabis science. And he brings up a very interesting study that shows that the use of marijuana by teenagers is not an accurate predictor of whether or not they'll drop out of school. We'll get the full skinny on that from Dr. Mitch here in just a minute. Also, I'm going to replay one of my interviews with Paul Armentano, the deputy director of Normal, because I feel this is a story that is just not getting the play it needs to get, and that is the research into the use of THC and cannabinoids in the treatment of cancers, specifically gliomas, the type of brain cancer that Senator Ted Kennedy is currently battling. So I'm going to replay that interview for you in the second half of the stash. Also, we got a great musical break. Big B and Cottonmouth Kings are going to grace us with a little We Can Smoke. And, of course, all your regular hemp headlines. So sit back and relax and enjoy your normal daily audio stash. Now it's time to take a look at the latest stories about marijuana from news organizations across America and around the world in our normal daily audio stash, Hemp Headlines. ...24-ounce limit proposed for medical marijuana in Washington. From the Seattle Times. Patients authorized to possess or grow marijuana for medical reasons under Washington law would be limited to 24 ounces of harvested marijuana, plus 6 mature plants and 18 immature plants, according to an official draft rule filed by the State Department of Health today. The filing of the draft rule starts a rulemaking process and a public comment period. A hearing has been scheduled for August 25th in Tumwater in Thurston County. The draft reduces amounts earlier considered by the Health Department and revealed in a Talking Points memo used to brief Governor Christine Gregoire in February. Health Department officials said in the February memo that they plan to recommend 35 ounces of harvested marijuana plus 100 square feet of plant growing area. Gregoire's staff told the Health Department officials that the amount appeared to be on the high side, and the law enforcement and medical providers should be consulted. The Health Department convened an advisory panel consisting mainly of law enforcement officials and a single doctor, a public health HIV/AIDS expert who does not care for patients directly. Law enforcement officials have said their main concern is being able to distinguish legitimate patients from those who are hiding behind the law to grow and sell large amounts of marijuana. They said they consider 3 ounces a reasonable amount for the 60-day supply specified in Washington's law, passed by voters in 1998. That law allows patients with certain chronic, fatal, or debilitating diseases to possess a 60-day supply with a doctor's authorization. The 24-ounce limit would put Washington State in line with Oregon's medical marijuana limits. Also, their 6 mature plants and 18 immature plants would match what is allowed in the state of Oregon. Anything would be better than the ambiguous 60-day supply, especially with law enforcement putting on their stethoscopes and declaring that a patient only needs 3 ounces for 2 months. Operation Southern Sweep. 450 agents, lots of seizures, no arrests. From the Eureka Reporter. A week after marijuana, cash, and weapons were seized from nearly 30 locations in Humboldt and Mendocino counties, a laundry list of those items has been released by a federal government agency. Federal Bureau of Investigation Special Agent Joseph Shadler said Tuesday that nearly 16,000 pot plants, nearly $200,000 in cash, 53 guns, 2 vehicles, 5 generators, a trailer, and 5 all-terrain vehicles were seized from the grow houses, homes, and a nearly 2,000-acre land parcel between both counties that were searched last week. About 450 federal, state, and local law enforcement personnel working what was dubbed Operation Southern Sweep targeted an alleged commercial marijuana growing and dealing operation that's been under investigation since early 2006. No charges have yet been filed against any suspects, and besides a man who was arrested June 24th on suspicion of assaulting a federal agent during the execution of the search warrants, no one has been arrested. The man has since been released and isn't facing charges, Shadler said. The FBI special agent also added, quote, "We're in the truth-finding business. If we collect evidence and there's nothing there, nobody will be charged. I don't suspect that will be the case, but that's always a possibility," end quote. 450 law enforcement agents from multiple agencies. Wow. That's got to cost a whole bunch, I imagine. Well, plus add in all that helicopter time and the various support vehicles and all the ancillary expenses like cataloging and storing the evidence. And after all that time and effort, no arrests and no charges. I wonder how else we could have spent that government time and money in Northern California this week. The U.S. Forest Service did not meet its own deadline to have 252 fully staffed fire engines available statewide by June 22nd, leaving inland forests potentially shorthanded going into the summer. As of Monday, more than a week after that target date, the agency remained 29 engines short of that goal, or almost 12%, spokesman John Heil said. He could provide no explanation. Heil said, quote, "We're not prepared to get into that now," end quote, noting that the agency was busy battling hundreds of fires in California. Cities and counties all over the state have sent fire engines and crews to battle the blazes in northern and central California. The fires, sparked by thousands of lightning strikes, covered more than 334,000 acres, primarily in the northern half of the state, he said. To help fight the blazes and fill the void left by unavailable engines, many Southern California-based Forest Service engines have been sent north, leaving area forests with fewer resources. While 334,000 acres of the Northern California forests are burning down, we've got 450 agents ripping up pot plants in 2,000 acres worth of land? Illinois man sentenced for stealing Pomeranian puppy, forcing it to inhale marijuana smoke. From the Chicago Tribune. A Plainfield man who stole a $1,500 Pomeranian puppy and blew smoke into its face until it passed out was sentenced Wednesday to 60 days in the DuPage County Jail. Judge John Kinsella told Emmanuel Lopez, age 19, quote, "The bottom rung of humanity abuses animals for their amusement. Anyone who abused animals for their own amusement has a problem," end quote. Lopez pleaded guilty in May to stealing the puppy on March 21st from a Petland store in Naperville. The dog was returned to the store 3 days later and has since been adopted. Naperville Police Detective Richard Arsenault testified Wednesday that after stealing the dog, Lopez and some friends drove around the area, quote, "blowing marijuana smoke into the dog's face until it passed out," end quote. Okay, let's get something straight. You do not force your animals to get stoned, period. It is animal abuse, it is unnecessary, and it is cruel. Now, there may be no real physical harm to the animal, since cannabis smoke is non-toxic, But it's unnatural for an animal to breathe any sort of smoke, and intoxicating their primitive brains probably stresses them out. It's like puppy torture. Besides, puppies are entertaining enough as it is, especially if you're stoned. On the other hand, I'd like to ask Judge Kinsella if he ever enjoys the entertainment value of the racetrack, the rodeo, or the circus.
Hello, I'm Paul Stanford from the Hemp and Cannabis Foundation, or THCF. Medical marijuana is legal in 12 states today, and THCF has medical clinics in 6 of those states. Our physicians help qualified patients obtain an authorization for medical marijuana in their state. Patients are eligible for medical marijuana with a history of either severe chronic pain and or nausea, cancer, AIDS or HIV, hepatitis, glaucoma, seizure disorders like epilepsy, chronic muscle spasms as in multiple sclerosis or asthma, neurodegenerative diseases such as Alzheimer's, and gastrointestinal disorders like IBS or Crohn's disease. If you or someone you know has one of these conditions, our doctors will help them obtain a permit for medical marijuana. THCF Medical Clinics has offices in Washington State, Oregon, Colorado, Nevada, Hawaii, and California. Call 1-800-723-0188 or go to the web at www.hemp.org or 1-800-723-0188.
Well, we're at the middle of the week, and that means it's time for some cannabis science with Dr. Mitch Earlywine, who's an associate professor of psychology at the State University of New York at Albany. Dr. Earlywine, welcome back.
Thanks so much.
You had sent me a great paper here that I thought we ought to talk about. You know, a lot of the problems that people will have with marijuana have to do with a lot of the notions of how it affects teenagers and how the dreaded weed is going to cause amotivational syndromes and schizophrenia, and we've talked about those things in the past. I thought this latest paper was interesting, though, in how it looks at the correlation, or I guess I should say lack of, between marijuana use and high school dropout. Explain what that paper was telling us.
Sure thing. I think nobody'd be too surprised to learn that, some heavy using teens do drop out of high school. But once you take into account a bunch of other variables that make a whole lot of more sense than marijuana, you find out that the link between marijuana and high school dropout really isn't significant anymore. What I like particularly about this paper is one of the authors is somebody who I actually debated against at USC 3 years ago about the legalization issue, and she is clearly not somebody who, you know, wants to see teen use increase and isn't somebody who's going to come out with a paper that says marijuana doesn't cause high school dropout unless it really looks like it doesn't. And so, you know, this is not like Ed Rosenthal and I wrote this paper or anything like that. These are people who are generally on the side of prohibition. And yet when they take a close look at their data, and this is literally thousands of students who filled out questionnaires about their marijuana use throughout junior high and then into high school, we find that, yes, at first glance it looks like the marijuana users are more likely to drop out, but once you take into account some other things, particularly relationships with peers, relationships with parents, and then oddly enough cigarette smoking, suddenly that relationship disappears. Now, usually when you talk to folks about this, they say something like, oh, marijuana is going to impair your intellectual performance, and that's what makes you do badly in school, and then you end up having to drop out. But in fact, a couple of papers that are cited here, including one by my friend Michael Newcomb at UCLA, shows that, in fact, these are often the students who were doing poorly in school before they used marijuana, often as early as fourth grade. Mm-hmm. These were the students who weren't connected to school or were doing poorly long before marijuana came into the picture. And what's curious as well is just, cigarette smoking, it's not something that people usually look at in these kinds of studies. And so I don't think that, you know, cigarettes suddenly impair your brain and make you bad at school. I think they're just a correlate of a whole bunch of things about attitudes and health and things along those lines that tend to lead to, among other things, dropping out of high school.
I think you got a really good point there, too, talking about the authors of this study not exactly being supportive of our side here. It reminds me a bit of Donald Tashkin's work at UCLA, where he was trying to find, you know, the proof that marijuana caused lung cancer and actually found quite the opposite.
And in fact, for 30 years he searched.
I mean,
he didn't just try it once. The guy really, really dug around. And Rosalie Pakula, who's one of the authors on here, who I really like her, but we just, you know, see things a little bit differently, is again somebody who would say we've got to do what we can to keep marijuana out of the hands of teens. And in fact, that's what Normal's really all about, is let's keep marijuana out of the hands of folks who shouldn't be using it by taxing and regulating it rather than leaving that to the underground market.
That's right. Take control over drugs like we take control over liquor and have it in liquor stores and such, and kids have a real hard time getting a hold of Jack Daniels. They don't have the ID. Now, as far as this report and the authors of this report, it seems to me a lot that, you know, this seems to be a recurring theme when you and I talk about these things, of how there's this confusion between correlation and causation, in that, you know, we saw it with a couple other studies where, you know, we find that it's the kids that may have already been predisposed to schizophrenia that are starting the marijuana, maybe to self-medicate. In this situation, you're talking about kids that may have been doing bad in school, who maybe they're depressed about that. Maybe they're disconnected from school somehow, and they're using the marijuana to cope. Do you see that as a common pattern in your research?
It's a big deal when you're studying humans, because a lot of times you can't do what you really need to do, and that's the classic experiment. I can't randomly assign some people to smoke marijuana for years and years and other people to not do it. The ethics behind that are just a little bit shaky. But of course, that's the way you really find out if one thing is the cause of another. So we end up doing these sort of correlational things and hoping for the best or seeing what's really consistent. But anytime you get some folks who do one behavior on their own, invariably they differ from other folks on a whole host of other measures. And in this case, what we're seeing is some unobservable things, probably economic things, probably social things, and maybe even certain values, things that you think are important, may co-vary with the decision to use cannabis early. And I'm concerned that actually some of these things are things that we could intervene with, and yet we're more focused on cannabis with these students. So in fact, there's a subset of students in this sample who clearly smoked cannabis and didn't drop out of high school, but obviously had some relationships with their parents or teachers or peers that buffered them against any negative consequences. God knows, Russ, I mean, you and I have been to enough conferences where people who started smoking cannabis in high school are now big successes. It's clearly not the cannabis itself. And if we focus on this, we miss the opportunity to improve relationships among students, improve relationships between students and their parents, get students connected to behaviors that are really fun for them, including studying, sports, any kind of religious observance, any of the things that a multifaceted life includes. And it's funny how once we build those up, the impact of cannabis we're going to see is really minimal.
Right. I often think sometimes the way that our whole culture is built to look at the drugs issue is more like, you know, we're trying to cure the symptoms rather than the disease. You know, that what leads these kids to get involved with marijuana, it's by the time they've gotten to the marijuana, the disease has already taken hold. The poverty, the disaffectation, the bad parental situation, whatever it might be. And I think you make a great point there that in by focusing on the marijuana itself as the bad cause, we blind ourselves to all the other possible causes out there.
It's funny because I do feel like that focus may be an easy one to make because it seems like this is an easier place to intervene. But actually, I think a lot of students would be much more interested in, let's talk about how to make good friends, than let's keep off the drugs, you know. Let's talk about how to talk to your parents and get them to have a nice relationship with you instead of let's talk about staying away from the evil weed.
Yeah, and we see so many of our policies, too, especially when we're talking about our school-age children here, that, you know, it's almost as if someone was trying to design a way to get kids to be on drugs. I'm thinking particularly like the drug testing regimes that say, you know, if you want to be in extracurricular activities, you have to take this drug test, when we've seen that being in extracurricular activities is a big way to keep kids off of the drugs.
Well, and the idea that you'd eliminate that buffer for the folks who need it the most is just extremely misguided. These data were gathered in South Dakota, so it's not a state that actually does a lot of that. And some of this is a more rural area, and that, in fact, can be a real big issue for, you know, rural students where there isn't a lot of the stereotypical fun things to do. And I feel like that time would be best spent, you know, getting these folks involved in neat activities, be it the arts, the sciences, sports, anything along those lines, instead of just berating them about using recreational drugs.
All right. Well, that's an interesting study. Thank you, Dr. Earlywine, for bringing that to our attention. And we just let everyone know that that according to this this study, it doesn't appear as though heavy cannabis use among youth is what leads to them dropping out. It may be that the factors that lead to them dropping out is also a factor that leads to the cannabis use. Is that a fair way to say it?
Absolutely.
Okay. Thanks, Dr. Earlywine, for joining us. We'll talk to you next week.
I'm Alan St. Pierre, Executive Director of Normal. Have you heard about the new super pot that's supposedly 20 times more potent than your father's Woodstock weed? Don't believe the hype. Marijuana's THC potency has always varied, even in the 60s and 70s. And the drug czar's numbers are full of, well, exaggerations. While no intoxicant is harmless, cannabis is non-toxic and far safer than alcohol. No matter how much you smoke, of whatever potency, you cannot die of a marijuana overdose. Potency is irrelevant anyway. More potent pot just means you smoke less of it, meaning less harmful smoke in your lungs. This is a prime example of harm reduction in action. Besides, the government already allows the prescription of THC pills. Its commercial brand name is Marinol, and it's 100% potent. Meanwhile, the federal government won't allow dying people to use natural marijuana, no matter what the potency. Does this make sense to you? Learn the facts about pot. Visit norml.org today.
Here at the Normal Daily Audio Stash, we work hard to change our nation's marijuana laws through education and discussion. But we also take time to relax and unwind with an eclectic mix of pod-safe music from many independent artists. We look for music that speaks to the growing truth about cannabis, or music that speaks to broader themes of freedom, liberty, social justice, equality, and protest. To find out more about the artists and download the music you hear on this podcast, just log on to stash.normal.org. And if you'd like to get your music heard by the online cannabis community, just send us an email at stash@normal.org.
All right, it's hump day, and it's time for a little party music to get us ready for the big four-day weekend coming up, Stashers. Big B brings the party with We Can Smoke. Today's track features our friends, the Cottonmouth Kings, as well. Taking some inspiration from that early 80s hit Safety Dance by Men Without Hats, Big B puts his spin on what has always been a feel-good party tune. No stranger to a party, Big B is from the capital of Partyville, Las Vegas, Nevada. You might have seen Big B on A&E's award-winning docudrama, Inked. When he isn't touring and creating music, he's probably getting some new ink, or just hanging out at Hart and Huntington in Las Vegas. If you happen to be in that party town, stop by and say hi to Big B. You can get more information on the album at our website, stash.normal.org, and a download of this MP3. It's Big B with We Can Smoke.
Big short sag low, followed by some smoke talking in my hand on the way to the show, because paid to a big D when it gets a little sauce in them. Or Johnny Richter when that pimp starts tossing them. Buttons up, party people, now it's party time. We're gonna drink and smoke and dance, just relax and lie. And do the nasty, who's down to procreate? Just a call when your period's a little late.
Hi, this is Willie Nelson, and I need your help. Our marijuana laws are terribly unfair, and they make criminals out of law-abiding citizens. Nearly 2,000 Americans are arrested every day on marijuana charges, and we are unfairly destroying the lives and careers of hundreds of thousands of people simply because they smoke marijuana. These are not criminals. They are average citizens like you, good neighbors who work hard, raise families, pay taxes, and contribute to their communities. And it's time we stopped arresting responsible marijuana smokers. We need your help to end marijuana prohibition once and for all. It's the fair thing to do.
For more information, contact NORML, the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws. Call toll-free 888-67-NORML or visit their website at norml.org.
Well, it's unfortunate news that kind of brings us here, of course. People have probably already heard now the unfortunate news about Senator Ted Kennedy from the state of Massachusetts, age 76, who has just recently had a seizure this weekend and has now been diagnosed with a type of brain cancer. And Paul brought this up on the NORML blog, and I thought it deserved some attention here, about the possibility of the use of cannabis and cannabinoids in the treatment of these types of brain cancer. So Paul, let's talk about that a little bit. First of all, what is this type of brain cancer that Senator Kennedy has?
Well, according to the news report, they said he was diagnosed with glioma. Glioma is essentially an all-encompassing term to refer to a particular types of brain cancer. You know, the short of this is it's really quite tragic. There are some types of gliomas that are slightly more aggressive than others, but the bottom line is the New York Times and some other outlets have reported, you know, about 50% of individuals diagnosed with gliomas, they pass away within 1 year, and really almost all of them pass away within 3 years, and that is even with the standard treatments available, which in this case are typically radiation or chemotherapy. Unfortunately, these types of cancers of the brain are typically so aggressive that by the time they're diagnosed, they've really taken such a foothold that there isn't much treatment that can be given. And these are also cancers that often reoccur even if radiation and chemotherapy are somewhat successful. So this is really, you know, sad news to hear.
Now, the part there where we come in has to do with some of the research that's been done specifically with regard to using cannabis, THC, marijuana, whatever, in the treatment of cancer. And specifically, we brought up some video from yourself and Dr. Behrman down at the clinical conference in California discussing about the latest studies from Dr. Guzman and other doctors. So let's tell people a little bit about that and what hope there might be for cannabis as a therapy here.
Dr. Behrman and I just ironically were talking about the research that is available looking at the potential to use components in marijuana as anti-cancer agents. For about 35 years or so, believe it or not, there have been investigators that have been testing whether the administration of certain constituents in marijuana, specifically THC, but CBD as well, could actually halt the progression of certain malignant cancerous tumors. And it would probably surprise, you know, many people listening to know that as far back as a study that was published in 1975 that was actually conducted in Virginia found you know, 34, 35 years ago, that when you administer doses of cannabinoids in lab rats that suffer from different types of malignant tumors, in this case, lung tumors were being tested, you actually see that the rats that have been treated, the tumors do not spread the way they do in animals that aren't treated, and you see an increase in survival in these animals. This was known and acknowledged, you know, as I said, you know, 34, 35 years ago. Unfortunately, almost since the publication of that study, there has been no follow-up work done in the United States to look at whether cannabis or cannabinoids can be a potential anti-cancer agent. Fortunately, there have been researchers, predominantly researchers in Israel, Spain, and Italy, who really over the last decade have published now several dozen papers looking at treating cancers with compounds in marijuana. In particular, they have looked at these brain cancers, these gliomas, and they have found really two remarkable things happen when cannabinoids are administered to animals suffering from glioma. Either A, the cannabinoids seem to target the malignant cells and kill those cells while leaving the surrounding cells healthy, and they also see that cannabinoids tend to cut off the blood supply to these tumors so that they cannot proliferate the way they would otherwise. Two really amazing results. It's just unfortunate that this research is taking place overseas and not taking place in this country.
And that's pretty much the magic bullet of cancer research, because the treatments now, of course, are, sure, we'll kill the cancer cells and we'll kill damn near every other cell in your body while we're doing it. So the idea that we could target those cells themselves and leave the rest of the cells healthy, that sounds like such an incredible breakthrough. So is it fair to say that the United States government at the very least is ignoring this research, or are they actively trying to suppress this type of research and understanding?
Well, you'd have to ask them. I mean, certainly they've ignored their own research going on three decades now. And it's, as I said, it's been up to scientists in other parts of the world to pick up where these American researchers left off in 1974 and 1975. You know, most interesting to me is that there was a pilot study published in 2006 where they actually injected THC into the cancerous tumors in the brain of 9 human subjects who were suffering from glioblastoma. And what they found was that in 2 of those subjects, they experienced a reduction in the proliferation of these cancerous tumors in the brain. To my knowledge, that is the only human trial that is available that has actually assessed whether the use of cannabinoids can reduce human brain cancers in patients. And I certainly would like to see some follow-up work done in this area.
Well, it certainly is some amazing, amazing scientific news to find this out. And we want to stress to everyone that nobody's here trying to claim that marijuana is the snake oil cure-all for everything. But certainly this type of research shows that there is promise in the use of cannabis and cannabis therapies for the treatment of some of these cancers. It really deserves more legitimate research. And we've got to end adult marijuana prohibition so that we can get these solutions out to the people that desperately need them. It shouldn't take a senator, unfortunately, being stricken with this for us to raise the issue. But if that's what it takes, then that's what it takes. It's something we need to make a change here in our policy.
Sure, and I want to be clear here to people listening. You know, none of these studies, and you can now read about a litany of them if you go to Normal's front page and look at the blog in the upcoming days, or if you go to my booklet, Emerging Clinical Applications for Cannabis. You know, none of these studies have assessed whether an individual smoking marijuana will see a reduction in the proliferation of cancer. These are all either preclinical trials that dealt with lab animals, or as I said, there is one human clinical trial, but in all of these cases, the cannabinoids were actually administered straight to the tumor. There was no inhalation taking place.
Right.
So it would be very hard from that data, if one could even do it at all, to extrapolate whether, you know, this other route of administration, inhaling cannabis the way, you know, so many people actually use it, would have the same effect. But it certainly does bear repeating that when cannabinoids are administered directly to these cancerous tumors or to these cancerous cells, they seem to have a dramatic effect at targeting and killing cancerous cells. And not just for brain cancers, but for a whole host of cancers, whether it's lung cancer, breast cancer, prostate cancer, pancreatic cancer, lymphoma. There's really quite a long list.
Mm. You know, I just can't help but think that had they discovered in 1975 some previously unknown plant that had these sort of effects, they'd have funded this research to the hilt and we'd have cured cancer by now. But because it's called marijuana, nobody can get their minds past the reefer madness lies, and we continue to be prohibited from doing legitimate research. It's just such a shame.
It really is, particularly when we see some of the progress that Manuel Guzman, a researcher in this area from Spain, and his research team has made literally just in the past 4 or 5 years, to think that, quite frankly, for the last 35 years, scientists could have been doing research in this area, but weren't and did not, simply because the drug in question was a component of marijuana. You know, it's really a shame we have to sit here and play what if, and it's certainly far more of a shame, it's tragic, that for the families over the years that have lost loved ones to this terrible disease, that they also have to ask what if.
It is a shame, but we'll keep fighting. We're going to hope for the best for Senator Kennedy and anyone else out there suffering from all these different forms of cancer. And here at Normal, we'll continue to fight to end adult marijuana prohibition so the research can continue and maybe save some lives. Paul Armentano is the deputy director of Normal and the author of the Clinical Applications for Cannabis pamphlet that you can get online at normal.org to answer all your questions about the research. Paul, thanks for joining us again.
Thank you, Russ.
Thank you for downloading the Normal Daily Audio Stash, the growing truth about cannabis. We are produced by the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws in Washington, D.C. Our executive producer is Alan St. Pierre. Our deputy director is Paul Armentano. Our webmaster is Brian Judy. And web production is provided by Red Aphid Interactive Media. As always, you can catch up on the latest information about marijuana at www.normal.org. And you can interact and download from our Audio Stash blog at stash.normal.org. For everyone here at Normal, I'm your host, Radical Russ Belville, hoping all your harvests are bountiful and your encounters with law enforcement are non-existent. We leave you today with a political cannabis quote from Kinky Friedman, the former gubernatorial candidate in Texas, who said, quote, "I agree with U.S. Senator John McCain that we've lost the drug war. Drugs are more available, they're cheaper. It's clear to me, if you've lost the war on drugs, then you've got to go some other direction. Marijuana is a very different situation. It's not like crack and other drugs that create violence." End quote. Well, Mr. Friedman, I don't know if John McCain still thinks that way. It's hard to tell where he stands on a lot of issues sometimes. But I'm glad to hear it coming from you. That's right, we've lost the war on drugs. It was not a war meant to be won anyway. It was a war meant to be waged. It's time to end adult marijuana prohibition and replace it with a system of regulation and control where responsible adults can use marijuana much like their alcohol-using counterparts, but we can keep it away from the children. I'm Radical Russ. Thanks for tuning in to the Daily Audio Stash. We'll be back tomorrow
with more news and interviews you can use. And until next time, take care of each other, tokers.